ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, on the 123 quiz on Tuesday, we spoke to Brenda Casey. And as I said earlier on, Brenda told us that she was studying to be a psychotherapist. And her area of speciality, I suppose, is disenfranchised grief. And it piqued our interest. And we got back on the phone to Brenda and we asked her, would she come in and have a chat with us about it? And she said, yeah, can I bring my friend Liz Gleeson in? She's a grief specialist and founder of Shapes of Grief. And we said, yeah, come in, the two E's. So Brenda Casey, Liz Gleeson, good afternoon. Thanks for coming in. So Brenda, it was probably obvious on Tuesday that I'd never heard of disenfranchised grief before. So just remind us what it is.
Hi, Ray. Thank you very much. So disenfranchised grief is described as a grief that's not openly acknowledged, socially supported or publicly mourned.
Right. So the things that we mentioned on Tuesday were things like the loss of a pet.
Yeah.
The loss of an ex-partner.
Yeah.
And an area that you have a lot of experience in, miscarriages.
Yeah.
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 And that's how you arrived to this field, is it? Because
it
you were a midwife.
Yes. So I trained originally as a nurse and then as a midwife and would have worked, as I said, for 27 long years in the National Maternity Hospital. But for the last 10 years, I've worked as a clinical specialist in bereavement. And I was drawn to that area because the word midwife means with woman, and people associate maternity hospitals with happy outcomes. But I seemed to have some grow for the not so happy outcomes. So it's an area I'm professionally passionate about, and I feel that we need to support women and their families who experience all types of pregnancy loss.
Well, let's just talk about that for a minute then. So you were the clinical midwife in loss.
Yes.
That was your title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bereavement and loss.
Yeah, and loss.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Because a miscarriage is, the definition of a miscarriage is the loss of a child before what stage?
Technically now before viability.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is 23, 24 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, of course, they're completely in the mindset, but people around them may not know that they're pregnant.
Absolutely. So it's a hidden loss, both physically and emotionally and mentally. And what strikes me from the women that and men that I support is that a lot of these women feel, even those people closest to them, minimize that loss.
Right.
You know, you can have another baby. You're only 7 weeks. Sure, you've got two kids already, you know. So they don't feel justified to grieve. And then they can feel confused and lonely and isolated. And again, in my professional experience, I see women, you know, because they don't feel justified, they put on a mask. So they go back to work and they pretend everything's fine. And they that's exhausting. And they are reluctant to seek support because they often think, God, I'm going mad. What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
So when I define it to them, you can nearly see their shoulders drop. I was like, oh, God, this has a name. I'm not going crazy. This is an appropriate response to what I've been through.
So although it's completely different to, say, losing a pet, the symptoms, if you like, are very similar.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Liz, just talk to us generally about grief then. Just, you know, we were talking about disenfranchised grief, but let's understand grief. It's obviously suffering a loss. People experience it differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, saying it's a loss, it's not just a bereavement. There's many, many losses that don't have a funeral. You know, the loss of a parent to Alzheimer's, the loss of a family member to addiction. There are so many losses that are ambiguous, is the term we use for that. And therefore, when it's not recognised, society doesn't roll in the way they would after a bereavement, for example.
Yeah, but I suppose we have images of grieving, don't we? You know,
yeah.
And it is, you lose a loved one, there is a funeral, you have a period of grief.
Exactly.
You know, and we see that dished up in fiction, in movies, in TV programmes.
We see it everywhere as a sad time after somebody we love dies, and you go through a process where the five stages of grief, which are completely mythical, by the way, until we find a happy ending. Mm. And the reality isn't like that at all. Grief isn't just an emotion, you know, it's a cluster of emotions. It can be anger, it can be anxiety. It's physical, it impacts every cell of our bodies when we go through a profound loss, a significant loss. It's emotional, it's physical, it's psychological. Our brains have to update to this thing that's happened. And we're not like apps. We can't press an update button and we get it. Like, we have to go through intense psychological processes to adjust to the world without somebody we love. So we can know that they've died, but truly feeling and accepting it's real is a process that can take 6, 12, 18 months, at which point everybody has stopped supporting us, right? So there's an argument that all grief is disenfranchised in a way, right? Eventually.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
are you still talking about that? Are you not over that yet? So,
grief. But that's, I suppose, disenfranchised grief is where that people probably in their heads think that you don't have a right. That's a bit strong, but get over yourself. It's only a cat. It's only a dog. That person, you went out with them years ago, but you haven't been with them in a long time.
Yeah.
All of those things. So in their, I suppose in their minds, they can't see why you would grieve this, because it's not the loss of a loved one.
That's it, because we're all unconsciously all the time creating a hierarchy about relationships and which relationships matter. So it might be my neighbour who's died, but like, who shows up when your neighbour has died, right?
Yeah.
Or it could be a friend, or even sibling loss, the amount of time somebody loses someone who's been in their life, their entire life, and people say, how's your mum? You know, as if their grief doesn't matter at all.
Yes,
so
yes,
they're, okay. We're disenfranchising grief all of the time. And this is really important, you know, because, as I said, it affects us on every level. It can cause significant decrements to health when we're not appropriately supported. And with regular grief or a bereavement that is recognised, that's, you know, supported by society, we've a chance to express our emotions, talk about the loss, discuss the circumstances of the death. All of this helps us to process it.
Yes.
And to help it become more real in ourselves, helps us to integrate it. If we don't have that opportunity because it's my ex-husband who died, therefore, nobody's asking me about it. Therefore, my grief isn't being acknowledged. I'm not able to process it. It's a harder, lonelier, longer process.
So you can't talk about it. You can't process it. And Brenda, that's the case with miscarriages for a lot of people, because they may keep it a secret.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, isn't it? That if your grief is secret, how do you expect support?
Exactly. And a lot of the women that I meet, they're, you know, generally in their early 30s, their friend groups, their sisters-in-law, maybe their own sisters or brothers are expecting babies at the same time. So they're trying to balance, you know, not saying anything because they're afraid of upsetting their loved ones.
Yeah.
So it's very complex. And yeah, they just feel really, really alone. So I've set up a bereavement support dedicated service in the hospital. It's only one day a week, but the women who've attended it have said that they found it invaluable in helping themselves cope.
So it's a safe space.
Yeah.
They can talk to you. Yeah. You've heard it all.
Yeah.
And in a world where they may not be able to talk to anybody else about it.
Exactly.
It is invaluable.
It is. So they feel they feel like, you know, it normalizes what they're experiencing and it validates it.
Yeah. You spoke about a hierarchy, Liz, and it's interesting because it's as if we measure. We measure if you are entitled to grieve certain things.
Yeah.
You know. And that thing about, we often hear about people grieving, for example, if a son or daughter comes out as gay. Some, you hear parents say they grieve the future that they thought they were going to have.
Absolutely.
You know, something like that.
Yeah.
So would that be an example of disenfranchised grief?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. You know, I have a contemporary whose daughter transitioned and the mother is grieving the loss of her child, that she thought she was going to have her daughter. She thought her daughter was going to have kids, and now she is identifying as they.
Yeah.
And she's very happy and very supportive of her, but she is continuously grieving the loss of her daughter.
And I can see how that wouldn't be supported.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a very sensitive area, isn't it?
Mm, Yeah.
If I could hop in as well there, Ray, like however difficult it is for families, think of the LGBT person at the centre of this and the loss of not being recognised. You know, I interviewed somebody on the Shapes of Grief podcast, Dr. Vanessa Lacey, who spoke about just the loneliness and the disenfranchisement, you know, of her transition and her family's rejection of that. But when her father was dying and she was in the room with him and one of the nurses came in and her father said, "This is my daughter, Vanessa." And oh, like I've shivers even telling you now, just
that
beauty
was a moment,
of just recognizing and giving her something back in that moment. But it's disenfranchised grief, actually, the term came from Dr. Kenneth Doka, who worked with people in the LGBT community. And he gave an example of a man working in the bank. He was a bank manager. And every time somebody was bereaved, they would get a little bit of time off work, cards from work, a bunch of flowers. Except when this man's male partner died, there was no cards. There was no time off work. There was no acknowledgement of the relationship.
Was that a long time ago?
It was.
It sounds like something now, that wouldn't happen now.
We are getting better, but we still are disenfranchising LGBT relationships and lives all of the time, you know, and minimising a lot of the grief that people have to go through, you know, as the result of being in any minority community. So I'm really glad you brought that up. And I think it's also important to say, it's not just the relationship, like whether it's our pet or our friend or our neighbour, but also circumstances of the death can disenfranchise a loss.
So, for example, if somebody died by suicide and the family decided for their own reasons that they weren't going to share that information with everybody. So they have this, they're living with this secret and maybe in their heads some sort of shame. And so they can't go through the grieving process. Mm. You know, other people are saying this and they know that and it's very complicated.
Yeah. Any loss, I think, that has a muzzle on it where we're not allowed, you know, we're not allowed to talk about it. That's just so painful. Or, you know, even with people dying of natural causes, but they don't want to know that they're dying and they don't want other people to talk about it. That's a very difficult position to be in. But you've said it spot on, you know, deaths by suicide, deaths by homicide, deaths by drug overdose or drug addiction.
Through addiction,
But through alcohol, these can be very, very stigmatized. People feel they don't have the language to really talk about their loss. Mm. Others don't want to address it. So we've the same problem here with disenfranchised grief where, you know, that society is just not rocking up in the way they normally do.
Now, we have a good reaction here. And if you want to get involved in the conversation, 51551 or 0870 32 32 32. Can you please ask your guest regarding grief, how come I'm constantly having recurring dreams of my late fiance as she died from cancer 3 years ago in October next? That's Tom there. Sorry for your loss, Tom. Is dreaming about a loss, is that a regular occurrence?
It is. It's really common. And it's, you know, obviously it's very hard to comment on one person's experience without knowing the full picture. Yeah. But, you know, there's something there that's wanting to be processed and probably wanting to be expressed and talked about and in a way integrated, you know. Yeah. Talking is really important, actually, when it comes to processing loss.
My daughter died a few months ago and the three children don't talk about her at all. Do I encourage them to talk or wait until they're ready themselves, Liz?
I think the mother herself there, or it might be a father there. Yeah. You know,
it sounds like a grandparent.
A grandparent.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just to model it, I think that's the best thing we can do for children is to model talking about them, having a tear in front of kids, you know, bringing that person into the conversation all the time. Children will find their way.
This is a truism, but people handle grief differently. And I'm wondering about in your work, Brenda, the partner, the man in the
absolutely.
Relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes a woman.
Right.
Don't forget.
Yes, of course. Sorry. Yes.
The second partner.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, in my experience, you know, people would say to the woman, the birthing person, "I'm really sorry that you've been through this." So we have to be really cognizant. And I am, you know, when I'm acknowledging the loss with the couple, I look them both in the eye and acknowledge them both. And generally, the male partner will say, oh, once Mary's okay, I'm fine. But that's him trying to be strong for her. And grieving people should not have to try and be strong, because that puts a huge onus of responsibility on them to be better than they are. So I know a lot of the charities that we work with through pregnancy loss have support for dads specifically. For example, Felicon have a football team, because men tend to grieve in a what's defined as an instrumental style. They tend to process it cognitively. They don't overtly express their emotions, and they tend to be future focused or process grief by doing. So Felicon, for example, their football team is a perfect example of getting a group of men together who've had a similar experience of pregnancy loss, kicking a ball around a pitch.
And, right.
So that's just one example.
That's interesting. So men tend to deal with it by doing things. And if you just think about it, the number of voluntary organisations set up around suicide or sick children that have been set up by men.
Yes,
you know, because
that's very
they're channeling their grief into something positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is you know, it's I suppose grief is a negative energy, but they're channeling it into something positive, which is.
And I see that in my work. You know, a lot of some men that I've had the experience and the privilege of meeting through my work, they would channel their grief into fundraising.
Yes. And of course, people grieve at different paces, don't they? And you rubbished already, Liz, the five steps of grief, the five stages of grief. Just why is that? I've read it so many times, it's been rubbished, hasn't it?
There's absolutely no
evidence
for
it. The denial and the anger and all that sort of thing.
And can I just come back to one thing you said there, Ray, which I think is really important about grief being a negative emotion? It isn't. It's as natural as love, you know? And I think we really have to start making space everywhere for grief to, you know, the only way through grief is to grieve. We need to encourage people to spill their tears, to talk about the difficult stuff. It's life. And I think the more we can embrace it rather than try to jump around it or step over it, the better it is for absolutely everybody, you know. But yeah, The Stages of Grief by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who did absolutely phenomenal work, by the way, for people who were dying. She noticed them when people found out they were terminally ill, that they went through this sort of process or these stages. And somewhere along the way, someone thought, oh, we don't have a grief theory. Let's stick that on it. But when we say there's stages of grief, we're insinuating there's a beginning, a middle and an end. We're insinuating it's linear, it's prescriptive, you know, that, you know, you're going in one direction only. And anyone listening who's going through any sort of loss will know it is so much more messy. We tend rather to be deep in our loss orientation, like in the grief, feeling the pain, yearning for the past, and then pushing ourselves forward, like trying to get a dinner on the table, maybe thinking about going back to work, you know, sort of planning our day to day. And then we're back in grief again. And then we're back trying to restore, and then back in grief. And this movement in and out of grief is much more normal than going through any linear process. We call that the dual process model.
Right. Okay.
You know, another model we talk about.
Because life goes on, I suppose.
Yeah. Another model we talk about is continuing bonds. Like when you love someone deeply, you don't get over them. You don't want to get over them. You don't want to move on. You want to learn how to relate to them now that they're physically absent. You know, and I often tell the story when my dad died a couple of years ago during COVID, actually. We had bird feeders outside the window, and while he was dying for weeks, I used to talk to him about the birds and the squirrels and who was at the bird feeders, and it brought us both a bit of peace and joy. The first thing I did after he died was I went out and I bought bird feeders. And it's how I continue a bond with my father when I watch the birds. It's this sense of love rather than pain, and a continued connection with him. And I want to encourage anyone who's lost someone that they love, find ways to continue that relationship.
So some of the language around grieving is outdated, like get over it and, you know, that those things, because you're never going to get over it, and people don't want to. They want to have this a presence of their lost loved one in their lives.
How do I learn with how do I learn to live with this, and who do I need to become to carry this?
Now, when you were on, Brenda, you know, we got a number of emails immediately after just our brief chat there on Tuesday. This was one of them. I can't believe that I'm hearing that psychotherapist talk about studying disenfranchised grief. Recently, an ex-partner whom I lived with for over 10 years and who co-parented my son died. I was grief-stricken as he was not an old man, but only one of my siblings sympathised with me. When I asked the others why they didn't, their response was something to the effect that they weren't, or that weren't we better off without him. The relationship obviously hit the rocks, but with my hand on my heart, I know that he was one of the best things to have happened to me. Because a relationship ends in tears doesn't mean that 100% of the relationship was bad. It was anything but. I learnt more from that man than from anybody else. He never talked down to me. There was no mansplaining in our relationship, and I always felt like a queen when I was out with him. So thanks to that woman who is studying this topic. So it is that thing that, you know, a relationship's over, or for people from the outside might have seen that it wasn't the best relationship for you, but you loved that person at some stage in your life and now they're gone.
Absolutely. And I'm really sorry to that listener to hear that she's going through that. And it's a really good example of disenfranchised grief. You know, she clearly loved him. The relationship was over and society is culturally telling her, you know, you're better off without him. But that bond, it's that attachment that she had with him. She's grieving the happy memories they had together and the love they had together. So it's really, I'm delighted that.
So that's it. That's it. And that's disenfranchised.
Yeah.
So here's another one that came in. Fascinated by your listener, Brenda, who's studying disenfranchised grief. I have a lifelong friend who has been mentally unwell for some time. I've been grieving the loss of our friendship for a year now, but none of my friends or family understand or want to know. They all dismiss her and the grief as, well, sure, she has changed. Brenda is studying something very important and hidden. So there. Your man, what was his name? I have his name there.
Dr. Kenneth Stoker.
Yeah. When did he coin the phrase?
I think it was 89, sometime
89.
In the late 80s.
Right,
yeah.
Now, there's loads of stuff coming in here. I had a miscarriage, then got diagnosed with breast cancer while going through IVF. I had one child through surrogacy, have a number of embryos in storage, a lot going on here. I want a sibling, but husband says no. It's all consuming for me. It's affecting my health. I'm not getting any younger. Any advice? Now, so refresh your memory there.
Yeah.
Had a miscarriage, then got diagnosed with breast cancer while going through IVF. Had one child through surrogacy, have a number of embryos in storage. I want a sibling. But husband says no.
I'm really sorry for your listener to hear that. There's so much loss there. You know, the breast cancer is complicating the reproductive loss and the infertility, and infertility being another type of disenfranchised grief that's not openly talked about. And as a society, we tend to minimise it. We try to fix people. So rather than, you know, we've two ears and one mouth for a reason. So we should use those appropriately. But I'm so, so sorry for that listener. Clearly, her husband is on a different page than she is. And she's that maternal instinct. She's doing everything possible to give herself a sibling. I would encourage her to maybe talk to somebody that she trusts. Maybe give herself some self-compassion and give herself some space. But that's also difficult for her because she's trying to balance the biological clock. She's not getting any younger.
And just, you brought something up, and our listeners brought something up there as well, is IVF and a number of rounds of IVF. And then at some stage, couples have to decide that that's all they can do. That's another example of disenfranchised grief,
totally,
as you said.
Totally.
And is that something that's talked about? And are people encouraged to go to counselling when after a number of rounds of IVF that they've?
Yeah, I do know that fertility clinics ethically should provide couples with appropriate counselling supports with people that are qualified to work in this area. It's a very It's a business model in a lot of fertility clinics. I know that the Murray Infertility Clinic that's aligned with Hollis Street is a not-for-profit organisation. And I know they do have counselling services. But a lot of the women that I meet through pregnancy loss would have gone through that fertility journey. And, you know, I can understand, you know, the biological clock and time ticking that you keep going till you get the pregnancy.
Or not.
Yeah. And maybe multiple miscarriages results in a conversation had to be had, like maybe this is not the path that we're going to be on. So, yes.
Now, one group that experienced unacknowledged grief, birth mothers. The grief experienced by this group in Ireland historically was shrouded in secrecy. The advice was, get on with your life. Young mothers were put under pressure to have babies adopted because of society's attitude towards unmarried mothers. Losing a child to adoption is the most painful grief and loss that never fully heals, says Mary.
Oh, it's so true. And in my practice, like I'm a grief therapist, often I will meet middle-aged women or women towards, you know, the latter years of their lives who might come because a spouse has died or a sibling has died. And then what really comes up is the baby they had 50 years ago that they never got to hold. They never got to name. They didn't even get to bury. So it's a massive, massively disenfranchised loss as well. Mm. And we forget about the grief we have for all the things we never had or the dreams that we will never fulfill, the babies that won't be born, the partners that haven't been met.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of losses of our dreams, our hopes and our assumptions about the future.
I think what this conversation is bringing home to me is that we need to be, and this goes without saying really, we need to be a lot more sensitive to people's situations.
Yeah.
I was going to get a T-shirt at one stage which says, you never know what's going on in people's lives. And you know, with disenfranchised grief, that is the case with a lot of people. You just don't know what's going on and what they might be grieving. My son has schizophrenia and it's ongoing grief. The loss, nobody acknowledges it.
Yeah.
That person. We had two miscarriages, one early, one late. The late one resulted in delivering the baby and a burial. I now find it hard to know how to mark the little spot at the side of the grave. It's a little memorial plaque. Is a little memorial plaque acceptable? I've never known how to mark this little angel.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think on that one, Brenda?
Yeah, you know, and especially early miscarriage. So she's had an early miscarriage and a late miscarriage. So, you know, often there's nothing tangible.
For the early miscarriages.
Yeah. And sometimes if a plaque feels right for her, that's what she needs to do. Some people plant a rose bush or maybe plant some flowers or write a letter or have a little memorial box, maybe with a scan picture if they have that. But it's very personal and it's very individual. So if that feels right for her, that's what she should do.
This topic, very emotional for me. I ended up in the perfect storm of grief where my mother had worsening dementia. My dad passed away unexpectedly at the end of COVID restrictions, so we didn't get to see him before he passed away. My relationship was breaking down and my daughter was suffering from extreme anxiety, self-harming and suicidal ideation. You poor thing. Mm. I have no idea how I managed to get through it and felt I couldn't really say or do much at the time. I feel like I only have the time and energy to start grieving all those things now. Deferred grief.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing?
Delayed grief. Delayed grief,
sorry.
Absolutely. And
deferred, like, sounds like you have some control over it.
Yeah, just my heart goes out to that listener and I'm so terribly sorry for all of those things you're juggling. For somebody like that, I imagine you're in survival mode. You're just getting from one thing to the next. You don't have time to sit with and process and integrate any of the losses because the next thing has happened. We call that bereavement overload, actually. Right. And, you know, I think these terms are really important because it gives people language for what they're experiencing.
And they know they're not on their own.
There's
a name for it.
If there's a name for it, someone else has been
exactly,
through this,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And, you know, like, how do we process grief for everybody? It's different. But, you know, as Brenda said, what feels right for her, to start naming it, even to write it down, even to create a map or a, you know, a timeline of these losses, just so she can see outside herself all the things that she's been through.
And it's like what Brenda said, self-compassion. And when you write all those things down, then you see that you're still standing and still getting up in the morning.
Yeah.
You need to say, well done.
We are incredible, Ray.
Yes,
like,
here we are.
You know, most people find a way to move through loss and to process intense grief. You know, 60% of people actually will find a way to process their grief with acknowledgement of the loss, validation of the feelings, compassion, kindness, a few lasagnas, you know,
yeah.
All of these things from people around us really help. And we need to keep an ear out for all of these disenfranchised griefs that don't get that support, especially ambiguous losses like mental health there.
And this one, I lost my eyesight as a young adult. I'm now in my late 30s, but I grieved for my old life for a long time.
Yeah.
The support that Brenda and her team provide is amazing and invaluable. Thank you, Brenda, for shining a light on the disenfranchised grief that is miscarriage and advocating to improve understanding for all of us who are going through it.
Thank you.
That's from Anne. Really interesting conversation. My retired assistant dog died last month. Just because we made the decision to have him put to sleep doesn't mean we were ready for it. But I think that's what people think. I've been exhausted for the last few weeks and only really connecting the two things now. I've been through human grief and animal grief before, so maybe was dismissing it this time, thinking I should get over it quicker. Is sleep loss a symptom of grieving? Yeah,
100%. Like, grief really impacts the body. And, you know, for most people in that acute phase of grief, like right after the loss, where you're just experiencing life with the lenses of loss on you, rumination, so going over things in your head, usually at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, when the mind is busy, sleep loss. It's essentially an intense stress response as well. So we've kind of a cocktail of adrenaline and cortisol going through the body. It hits the immune system. There's very little of our body that grief doesn't impact.
Yes, yeah.
It can make us more unwell, and it can make us feel like we're going a little bit crazy at times as well, the intensity of it.
Well, thank you so much to you, Brenda and Liz, for helping us to explore this disenfranchised grief. I'm sure it's something we'll come back to. There's somebody saying that their brother's an alcoholic and they grieve every day for the brother they had long ago.
Yeah.
And you see, it's now it all makes sense to people.
Yes.
So even that chat,
I think,
was enlightening.
Wonderful?
That is
isn't
wonderful.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Brenda, good luck with completing your thesis. Liz, good
thank
to see you.
And
thank you so much for coming in. Thank you both.
Thank you, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.